You would open your Bibles this evening to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus, chapter 32. We're going to take a week hiatus from our 2 Samuel study. And I've given you all a handout. And tonight is going to be different. It's going to be different than what we normally do on Sunday night. It's just going to be different. Bear with me. Be patient with me. I hope that it will be beneficial to you as well. Miss Pat has, and honey, if you don't mind, maybe get that started around, that workbook, as most of you, I guess, are aware, on Tuesday I drove up to Tennessee with the purpose of going to a workshop. It's Charles Simeon, who's a preacher. The workshop was Wednesday, Thursday, half the day, Friday, in that folder there. They had a couple of extras, so I snagged one to bring back to you so you could see it. The schedule and places there for notes and different things. I just thought I might share that with you. The church graciously gives me some money so that I can try to get some furthering education, and after being there, I know I need more education. I go to, God has graciously provided much through you all. So some of the conferences that I go to are just preachers preaching, and so I'm faith. And then some of them are conferences where I'm being taught. But this particular workshop, seminar, conference, whatever you want to call it, was different in that it was completely interactive. Some 40 or 45 pastors, not all pastors, I should say. Some were teachers in their church. Some were retired, just retired men who had just wanted to learn more about how to study the Bible. So it was a good combination of people there. But this one was, every person was assigned a text, two texts. I had one from Exodus chapter 10, and then I had the entirety of Exodus 32 here. And you had to prepare a sermon using the outline that I have handed you, giving you this as a tool. You had to prepare a sermon, and then you had to present that sermon in a group. So we sat down with a group of 10 men. There were 10 of us in a room. They broke out in like 5 different groups, I think. You sat down with a group of 10 men, and you presented your outline. You didn't have to have a full manuscript, but you presented your outline, and then the guys in the room picked it apart. Graciously, kindly, Christian-like, showed you what was good and where you needed to improve. And I would say that probably of all that the seminars and conferences that I've been to, this one was probably the most helpful. It was also the most taxing and tiring because you've got to pay attention. And it was full days of this, 2.5 full days of this. And I went home, went back to my dad's, mentally exhausted, just wiped out, and still had to, try to tweak these so I didn't look like a complete Neanderthal to my group. But nonetheless, what I want to do with you this evening is just to spend a few minutes to walk you through this handout and paint some bigger pictures for you. And I have learned, I was benefited by it. And if you walk away tonight knowing more about Exodus, it'll be beneficial for you too. All right? There's something that I think we forget. For those of you who teach or may teach, listen and learn. There is the original audience that the writer is writing about. Okay? And there is the original audience that the writer is writing to. Sometimes those are the same. Let's say Paul, writing to the church at Corinth, he's writing to the Corinthians about the Corinthians. right? You with me on that? So let's take the Pentateuch. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Those first five books of the Bible are written about creation, the flood, the Abrahamic covenant, the Exodus, the Levitical law, the numbering of the people. But it is actually written to that second generation of Jews who are about to enter into the promised land. And this is something that I miss sometimes. And then even though I've been studying this book for over 25 years, I still have so much to learn. But one of the richest thoughts that I got out of this was seeing Moses, as he is inspired by God to pen these words, writing to that next generation of Jews who were not alive, the majority of them. Remember, anybody who was over 20 years old died in the wilderness except for Joshua and Caleb, and everybody else was young. They weren't alive to see the plagues. They weren't alive to see the Red Sea parted. And as Moses, you know, he does not allow to lead them across the Jordan into the promised land, but his heart is still for his people. So he's pouring into his people these truths, like Exodus 32. So he is writing to that generation about a previous generation. And what preachers and others are compelled to do is to take those two truths and apply it to today's generation. Writing to the second generation about the first generation, and we have to make it applicable to our generation. Okay? Let me read a few verses from Exodus 32. And then, if you'll just allow me this evening, I know it's different, and I'm not going to keep you as long tonight as normal, but I want you to see some of the work that goes in, and I hope maybe be blessed and benefited by studying a little bit more. Exodus, I preached almost through the whole book when we began 8 years ago, and I just want to start all over now, so I feel like I do better now. Exodus 32, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, Up, get up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not, that's old English for we don't know what has become of him. And Aaron said unto them, Break off the golden earrings which or in the ears of your wives and of your sons and of your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. And he received them at their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, These be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. When Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made proclamation and said, Tomorrow is the feast to the Lord. And they rose up early on the morrow and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. Let's just stop there. And we're not going to read the whole chapter, and we're not going to really exposit every verse of the chapter. So we were given this worksheet that you have in your hands, and the questions, 1 through 7, were what we were to fill in and answer based on our study of the passage. And the first question it asked is, how has the author organized this passage? And if you will read the entirety of the chapter, you'll notice that it is both narrative and dialogue. In other words, it's telling a story, but there's also conversation back and forth. It is telling the story, but there's a conversation between Israel and Aaron, between God and Moses, between Moses and Joshua, between Moses and the people, and then between, again, Moses and God. So there's narrative and there's dialogue. And there's several location changes. It's something that one of the teachers brought out that says, if you want to learn how to study the Bible, follow the camera. What is the camera focusing on? The camera, the video camera, and we're using figurative language. For example, the chapter opens at the base of the mountain, and so the camera is focusing in on Israel at the base of Mount Sinai and their stubborn rebellion in building a golden calf. Then the camera shifts to the top of the mountain where Moses is there meeting with God. What is really kind of interesting is that, again, you got to get into some of this background, not to get ahead of myself, but Moses has been out, you know, he's been out 40 days. People, we don't know what's happened to him, whether he's coming back or not. In fact, this event actually interrupts. God has Moses on the mountain and he's handing him the civil law and the ceremonial law, the construction of the tabernacle and the vessels of the tabernacle. And then there's an abrupt halt. This 32nd chapter is actually an abrupt interruption of the instructions that God is giving to Moses about the tabernacle. And God's saying, I want you, Moses, look at them, look at those sinners down there. You ought to see what they're doing down there. And it interrupts this conversation between God and the instructions given concerning the construction of the tabernacle. So follow. So this was me that I brought it out this way. At the base of the mountain, there's law of breaking. And at the peak of the mountain, the top of the mountain, there's law of giving. And there's a contrast, I think, intentional in that. Moses and Joshua go down the mountain together. And down the mountain, they discover that the law-giving deliverer has been forgotten, and the people are worshiping a golden calf. Golden calf. And then the scene, the camera, if you will, focuses at the base of the mountain as Moses is livid. And if you think about some of these things, I missed this stuff, and I'm sure I'm still missing things. What does Moses do with those? Do you remember what Moses does with the two tables of stone? Throws them down and breaks them, right, at the base of the mountain. And it wasn't until I was sitting in class till it sort of, I think, dawned on me that that was a symbolic act of breaking of the law, which is exactly what Israel was doing. He crushed the law, broke the law, because Israel was breaking the law. Just a symbolic act there. And these are things that, you know, you're not always going to get, and you don't want to make too much of, but there's something to be said there. Down at the base of the mountain, as Joshua and Moses make their way down, at the base of the mountain, there's the ugliness and consequences of idolatry. The people are in a lewd, sinful, giving themselves over to all kinds of wickedness. And they're going to face the consequences of that. If you'll remember, again, I don't want to read the whole chapter, but if you remember, Moses actually takes that golden calf, grinds it up, and puts it into their drinking water and forces Israel to drink it. So you want these gods here, you can have them. You want this to be your God, take it into you. This can be your God. And then there's the Levites who take sword in hand and wipe out a large number of the sinful Jews. And then Moses goes back up the mountain. If you'll remember our study of Exodus, has been many years ago now, but Moses at 80 years old, don't forget this, he's 80 years old, he's climbing back up that mountain again. He made, I think, 8, 9, I can't remember exactly how many trips up and down the mountain, but he goes back up to the mountain, and there he offers prayer and intercession for the people. There are different literary devices. Being and now is used, so a conversational, situational transition. But here's the emphasis. Israel has been removed from Egypt, but Egypt's idolatrous ways have not been removed from Israel. You get that? They've taken Israel, come up out of Egypt, but they still got a whole lot of Egypt in their heart. Old ways die hard. And then that second question that you have in front of you is, how does the context inform the meaning of the passage? They're different. You see that, and this will help you if you seriously want to study some Bible. There's a literary context, historical context, cultural context, and a biblical context. You don't have to understand all of that. This is some of what I try to do and hand off to you. But in the literary context, again, Moses has been absent since chapter 24, verse 18. His absence leads to their departure from true worship. And this is one of the most shocking things, and this is what the author wants us to get from this. In the literary context, remember, God has performed numerous miracles. The plagues that he brought in Egypt. In particular, I had Exodus 10, the plague of darkness, was one of the other lessons I had to prepare, message I had to prepare. Do you remember that in that plague, God drew a line in the sand? And in all of Egypt, it was pure blackness that could be felt. But in Goshen, it was daylight. Well, who could do that except God? He showed grace to Goshen and fury to Pharaoh. And Israel saw that. They saw the locust and the pestilence and the hail and the darkness and the death of the firstborn. And then God parts the Red Sea and they walk across on dry ground. And then just days, not even a month and a half before this, God vocally thunders from Mount Sinai. You remember Mount Sinai? The mountain's on fire, it's smoke, it's shaking. And then the very voice of God thunders, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." God vocally speaks from the mountain, and so much that they're scared to death. And they say, "Moses, you go talk to God for us because we just can't handle this. It's too much for us." And now, after witnessing all of that, Israel still rebels and makes a golden calf and says, "This is the gods. These are the gods that brought you up out of Egypt." And it should be shocking to us when we read that. And that's what the author wants us to see. The historical and biblical context is that Moses is absent because he's at the top of the mountain receiving divine direction for how Yahweh is to be worshipped, while Israel is at the base of the mountain ignoring the most basic instructions already given them. And I cite Exodus 20, verses 4 through 6, which is, "Thou shalt not make any graven image, not bow down before thee." Moses at the top of the mountain giving all these specific instructions on how Yahweh is to be worshipped, rightly worshipped, and there's Israel down at the base of the mountain, and they can't even keep the ten laws for 40 days. Interesting again, as I quote here in chapter 19, verse 8, they have just said, "Whatever the Lord wants us to do, we'll do it." What is the main point, number 3, that the author is arguing to his audience? I got this one all wrong in class, so I had to rewrite it. My instructor said, "Gently, Bill Lewis, you hit a big zero on this one. You need to redo it." He was right. He was absolutely right. That's what was so beneficial about it. I think now that what is the main point the author is arguing to his audience? Again, he is speaking to the second generation that's about to enter into Canaan, about the first generation. And his main point is, don't repeat the mistakes of your parents by forgetting God and turning to idols. Okay? And then, of course, every sermon, there should be some kind of connection to the gospel, to the redemptive work of Christ. So number 4, how does this passage connect to the gospel? What part of the gospel is in view? And this is how I answered that we are all by nature idolaters, by nature, worshiping whatever brings us the most comfort and satisfaction. We need someone to teach us of the one true God and how we can be reconciled to Him. Jesus is the law keeper and the law giver, but we are the law breakers, constantly turning away from our Creator to worship and serve lesser things. And then in this passage, there are a couple of clear portraits of Christ. We find in the Old Testament that it says that God is going to raise up a prophet like unto Moses. In fact, in Exodus, God is going to raise up a prophet like unto Moses, but better. But better. Moses, in this passage, Exodus 32, like Christ, intercedes for his people. Moses and Jesus pleads with God to show patience and grace. And Moses also, and we'll mention this again in a moment, shows his willingness to take the wrath of God in behalf of rebellious sinners. Moses says, don't punish them, give it to me. Jesus said, don't punish them, give it to me. And this is here. This is some of the richness of it. Number five, what is the main point? You know, that as Brother David Miller would say, somebody asked him how many points should a good sermon have, and he said, at least one. At least one. What is the main point you will argue to your audience? And that is that we too, now brothers and sisters, this is where we take the Old Testament text and bring it to today. We too can have short memories and forget who truly has delivered us and what He has delivered us from. Aren't we all prone to forget what God did yesterday when we have trouble today? And often turn to lesser things to seek comfort or contentment? I want to skip number six, and we're going to come back to it, and there's a reason for that. Let's go to number seven on the back of the page. So what is your sermon title and your preaching outline? My sermon title would be Prone to Wonder. If I was going to give a title to it, that's what it would be. That we are all prone to wonder. Israel, first generation, was prone to wonder. The second generation was prone to wonder. Are you ready? God's people are still prone to wonder. And these lyrics, and I have that in my note from Come Thou Fount. I would use this as I do sometimes. Listen to this. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor. Daily I am constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. Prone to wonder, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart. Oh, take and seal it for thy courts above. Each of us are prone to wonder, to turn from the one true God. We all have our idols that we battle with, self, sport, whatever that it is, and we all have them. I know I've said this before. I'll say it again. One guy said, I've never seen that song. I'm not prone to wonder. I said, well, good for you, Jack, because I am. I'm prone to wonder. Get my mind and heart away from God. So anyway, that would be, you know, if I were preaching this, I would use that as an opening illustration. The thesis, and this is some of the preacher work that goes into that, I'm not going to say you don't care. It's just this is what I do. A thesis is a one-sentence statement that summarizes. Is that a word? Or did I just make that up? That summarizes a passage. What I try to do, if you'll notice in the bulletin, normally beneath the sermon title and text, there is generally a one-sentence summary of what this sermon is going to be about. And that's what the thesis is. And the major objective that would come from this, you see that body of the message would include explanation and application for each. And I'm just going to read this in one moment, make a few little remarks about it. You see it here, the body of the sermon, verses 1 through 6, a divided heart leads to foolish behavior. And that's what happened to Israel, their divided heart, not fully committed to the one true God, led them to make a golden calf, to turn to something lesser. Verses 7 through 10, an angry God leads to potential disaster. Now, we didn't read it, but in verses 7 through 10, this is... You know what God says to Moses? Moses, go down there and do something about your people. He doesn't say my people. You look at it and see, Moses, you go do something about your people. Because I'm fixing to kill them all. I've had it with them. I'll start over with you and make an entire new generation of Jews. Which leads to my third point, verses 11 through 18. A faithful intercessor pleads for the people. And up on the mountaintop, we see Moses saying, Lord, don't do that. Lord, don't kill them. Lord, be patient. And I can't help myself. 1 John 2 says, we have an advocate with the Father, even Jesus Christ the righteous. Now, I've got that in my application, but I'm getting ahead of it. So just like Moses would plead for the people, Jesus pleads in our behalf. Fourth point, sinful decisions lead to severe consequences. In verse 19 through 29, Moses comes down, he throws down the tablet, he grinds the idol up in powder, has him drink it. And do you remember what Aaron said when Moses confronted him? Moses says, my brother, why on earth did you capitulate to the people and build a golden calf? Do you remember the absurdity of Aaron's response? I can't really explain it, Moses. I took the gold they gave me and threw it into the fire and poof, out came a golden calf. Here's my application. You're going to see it in just a minute. That would be laughable if the consequences of it weren't so severe. But do you know how silly that sounds? Just as silly as we sound when we make a bunch of excuses for our sin before God. That's just how silly we sound. Because God knows exactly what has happened in here. And then verses 30 through 35, a willing substitute shows us Christ. And that is, in those verses, God again says, and He does punish Israel, but Moses says, Lord, give it to me. Don't punish them. Blot my name out of the book, but let them live. And that's His willingness to serve as a substitute, to take the blunt of God's wrath, which is exactly what Jesus has done for us. He took the wrath of God at Calvary in our behalf. Father, don't pour it on them. I will take it in their behalf. This chapter ends on a negative tone of heavy judgment. Even though Moses intercedes, those who are guilty still suffer. They still suffer consequences of their sins. And this is one of the major things, and I mentioned this, and I want to follow up on this. In bold, you see, this challenging the original audience to think seriously of their own inclinations to idolatry and forgetfulness. Now, here's a contrast that, again, I didn't think about until I was forced to sit down and revisit this. Now, just think. These Jews, this second generation, those to whom Moses is writing to, they too have just been delivered. Not from 400 years of slavery, but from 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. God will part the Jordan River just like He did the Red Sea, right? And they're going to cross the Jordan River on dry ground. As they conquer the land of Canaan, God will perform numerous miracles. The sun will stand still. He'll rain down brimstone from heaven. The walls of Jericho are going to come crashing down. God performs all kinds of supernatural miracles, just like He did in Egypt. And the warning is, Israel and us, do not turn away from the one true God alone who can deliver. But do you remember what happens? After a few years, Jeroboam, the son of Solomon, what is it that he constructs? Two golden calves. Puts one in Dan and another in Bethel. They did not heed this warning. Do you get that? There's such a clear parallel there. God has delivered you. He is the only one who can deliver you. He's given you signs and miracles and wonders and victory. Don't neglect Him. Don't turn away from Him. But what do? They turn right away. Prone to wonder. Lord, I feel it. If you jump back up to number 6, what applications would you make? And I've mentioned these as we've made our way, so let me work quick. When faced with adversity and uncertainty, we quickly forget God's faithfulness to us. We quickly turn to different avenues seeking security, all of which are golden calves that cannot save. Aaron's excuse will be laughable, we're not so serious, yet our excuses for disobedience are folly in God's sight. Christian, take a bold stand. Imagine how things may have been differently if Aaron had done what Exodus 23:2 says, not to follow a multitude to do evil. What if Aaron would have said, don't do this folly? Moses is on the mount talking with God. He's going to be back. Stay true to the one true God. Stay true to Him. But he didn't. He yielded to their peer pressure. The warning, 1 Corinthians 10:14, flee from idolatry, false gods, and false worship. Not only dishonors God, but it leads to judgment and death. Find, here's the application, find forgiveness and rest. Christian, forgiveness and rest in the intercessory work of Christ in your behalf. We have an advocate greater than Moses. And I noted this, though God may be angry with us, Jesus is praying for us. You can rest in that. And the Father hears Him always. And I chose to make mention of Jesus speaking to Peter, Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you. It's a sweet thought to know that the Lord Jesus Christ is praying for me. Praying for me. He is the sinner's substitute, willing to take their place and bore the wrath that they deserve, as found in verse 32. And then down at the bottom of the page, in closing, we're all inclined to idolatry, as the song says, prone to wander. You can read it. There is no life to be found in golden calves made by men. There's no grace or forgiveness given from stone statues or idols. But forgiveness and redemption can be found in the intercessory work of the sinner's substitute, a prophet like unto Moses, but better. But better. And that is just one of the lessons that I taught. I taught two of them. And then we ended up doing, if you saw in the handout there, we ended up doing several of those with different guys. It was really rich, really helpful. And that just gives you a little bit of behind the scenes into what we try to do back here in this room, in this study, in sermon prep, and getting things ready for it. Okay. That second generation didn't listen. They didn't listen. Moses is telling them, this is what happened. Don't repeat. And then they went ahead and repeated. 1 Corinthians tells us that all of those things happened as an example to us, lest we yield ourselves to idolatry. So anyway, we're prone to wonder, but God is faithful. He cannot deny Himself. God bless you. I love you. I hope.